listening to Truth to You with Jono on the Meander Radio Network. Remember, all programs are available to download at truth2u.org. That's truth, number two, letter U.org. And g'day to everybody listening, wherever you may be around the world. Thank you for your company. Joining me this hour is Nehemiah Gordon and Keith Johnson. Keith is the author of His Hallowed Name Revealed. Again, also available as a 12-episode DVD series. Additionally, Keith is the co-author with Nehemiah Gordon of the book A Prayer to Our Father, The Hebrew Origins of the Lord's Prayer, which is now available in a live three-part DVD series. Nehemiah is also the author of The Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus, and it's also available in a live DVD teaching as well from truthtoyou.org. Gentlemen, welcome back to Pearls from the Torah portion.
Shalom.
Grand to have you again. Grand
to talk to you, Jonah, but you're going to have to slow down because you're starting to say this by rote. You know, you're going to have to talk about how exciting it is that you've got us on the radio. And
if we write any more books, then what is time to talk about the Torah portion?
It'll be a little bit. No, it's a combination of the excitement and the caffeine. And
for me, it's just the caffeine. Woo!
Hey, tell me a little bit. Now let's slow it down. I mean, let's slow it down. Just tell me a little bit, because this is a new thing. Just remind everybody about, Keith, about the live three-part DVD series. Give it to us in a nutshell.
Well, here's what's exciting. Nehemiah Gordon said it himself on the on our Torah portion, that, you know, it's probably the best teaching he says that he's done that's been caught on DVD. And of course, that's available. In fact, it'll be available right there in Australia on your site. And also it's available at hishallowedname.com and soon to be available on aprayertoourfather.com. What I'm excited about with what Nehemiah and I have done over the last couple of years is that when we've gone on tour, this last tour was so exciting to me, because every place we left something behind. And it's the spirit by which he and I have taken the approach to both our books and the DVD series, is that we don't want people to say, oh, Nehemiah said, or Keith said, or Jono said. We want them to learn it for themselves. And so now we've got enough, what I call information, inspiration, and now some revelation that we can leave behind through both books, DVD series, etc. We're actually able to give people some tools. And that's really why I want to plug that a little bit. It's just because it feels good to know that what we're giving them is going to be for them, and it's not about us. So that's why I wanted to slow down a little bit.
And what you're giving them, I mean, it's not short. It's 6 hours worth. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yeah, 6 hours worth of teaching on the DVD series. Mm. Of course, we've got something else we're working on. Hopefully, they'll be coming out before the end of the year from our most recent tour. And then, of course, the books, you know, Hebrew Yeshua, Greek Jesus, the teaching that Nehemiah does, His Hallowed Name, the 12, you know, 6 hours of teaching there, A Prayer to Our Father, and now a DVD that goes along with that. It gives people a chance to read, interact, you know, listen, use all of their senses to get this information for themselves.
Amen. Amen. But that's not what we're talking about this week. This week we are in Vayetze. Is that right? Have I pronounced that correctly?
Vayetze.
Thank you, Nehemiah. Bereshit 28:10-32:2. And we're talking about Jacob's vow at Bethel, his marriage to Leah and Rachel, his escape from Laban, among other things. And it begins like this in verse 10, if I may kick it off. Here we go. It says here, now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went towards Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. It sounds like he used a stone for a pillow. And there's some really bizarre myths about this particular stone. Are you guys familiar with any of those?
No, what are some of the myths?
Well, this stone is called, I believe it's British Israelism that refers to it as the Stone of Scone, or the Stone of Scone, I believe it's pronounced.
Isn't the scone a type of pastry? Maybe it's a really hard pastry.
The Stone of Scone has been left out in the sun a little bit too long. No, there's some bizarre stuff. British Israelism, they believe that it is that they actually have the stone. They're in possession of the stone, and it is upon that stone that new kings and queens are crowned, and that it was brought over there by Jeremiah. And there's some really, really bizarre stuff about that. Anyhow. So there it is, but it continues on. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. This is the escalator of heaven, Nehemiah.
Okay.
Well, isn't it?
The escalator of heaven, I suppose. Sure,
yeah,
why not?
Well, it sounds like one of those shopping escalators where people are going up and down on them, and he's
basically what you're saying is Bethel is the entrance to the mall.
Well, actually, isn't that what Jacob says? Jacob says, "Hey, check it out. I mean, behold," it goes on to say, "Behold, Yehovah stood above it and said, I am Yehovah Elohim of Abraham, your father, and the Elohim of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust upon the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Of course, we've already touched on the fact that the NIV says through. But anyway, we'll move on from there. "Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. And when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he said, surely Yehovah is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid, and he said, how awesome is this place? There is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven."
It really raises an interesting question. So here we have the story about Bethel or Bethel in Hebrew, and Bethel means house of God. And at the end of the story, that's not the original name of the place. It tells us originally the place was called Luz, and Jacob renamed it Bethel, house of God. Mm-hmm. And then in verse 22, he says, "And this stone which I have placed as a matzeva," which is like a standing stone, "shall be the house of God," which like really raises some questions. That stone was the house of God, or it marks the place of the house of God. And either way, which house of God are we talking about? We think of, well, the place of the house of God, that's the temple in Jerusalem, right?
Sure.
So what's the role of Bethel? And we got to remember that Jerusalem wasn't actually proclaimed and chosen until an incident that happened in the time of David. And at mm-hmm. that point, God said, "I choose this place forever." But up until then, the place that God chose as the site of his tabernacle was something that was dynamic. It would, wherever the cloud would land in the desert, that was the place they would set up the tabernacle. And once they came into the land, the tabernacle remained mobile and would be for a time at Shiloh or Shiloh, for a time it would be at Shechem or Shechem, and then for a time it would be at Bethel and possibly other locations as well. So apparently there was a time when it was at Bethel, and you can actually see that later on in the Bible. We hear a little bit about that.
Sure, Keith.
So question, my question is this. So is there anything that we know about Bethel that qualifies it more than any of those other places?
No, I wouldn't say that it's more qualified. I mean, this is the place. This is one of the places where the tabernacle would later be set up. Before Jerusalem was chosen, and the history of why that was a valid place for that is what happened with Jacob. That's the point. I think that's the point of the story. Mm-hmm. But when we read the story today, it almost sounds like anachronistic. We're like, well, wait a minute. Bethel isn't the spot anymore. And if you don't remember at one time, before Jerusalem was chosen, you hear this and you're like, well, what's going on? What, Bethel, but that's not the spot. All the way to the point where you'll have some people who will say, well, oh no, Bethel, that's just another name for Jerusalem, which it's not. Mm-hmm. It's very clearly a different
site.
Jerusalem was called Shalem at the time, back then, and Bethel was called Luz, two completely different cities.
Sure. Wow. Entirely different places. So then,
that's a Torah pearl.
That's a Torah pearl.
You can see in Judges chapter 1 that Bethel is the place where everybody comes together to consult God. That's in Judges 1.
Mm-hmm. Then Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had at his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. What is the significance of that?
So he's anointing it.
Okay.
This was the way you dedicated something in ancient times. You anointed it with oil. That's why they poured oil on the head of the king. It was a way of dedicating him.
Mm.
The way they christen a boat today. What does it mean to christen a boat? It means they break a bottle of wine or champagne over it, and that the liquid pours on it, and that's christening. Well, christen means to anoint.
Sure.
So he's simply anointing it with oil. Now, it is strange that he's doing this, and it's so strange because in the book of Deuteronomy, it tells us, don't set up these matzevot, these standing stones.
Mm-hmm.
So something that our ancestor Jacob did, and we also see that Abraham did this, we're later told in Deuteronomy, okay, don't do that anymore. And the reason is that the people were confusing the standing stone with what it represented. Here, what it represented was, marking the spot where Jacob had this vision. Mm-hmm. What happened is the people would come and then worship the stone. And so God commanded, okay, just don't even set up those stones anymore. So here's an example of something the forefather did that we're not supposed to emulate, which is kind of strange. So why are we being told the story? And I guess we're being told the story because it's part of the history of how things came about.
Sure. Okay. And then Jacob made a vow saying, and it seems conditional, doesn't it? If, it begins with if. Definitely. Yeah. If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I will come back to my father's house in peace, then Yehovah shall be my Elohim. And this stone, which I have set up as a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you... Now, here we see this again. Of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. Now, this is the second time that we see a tenth, isn't it?
Now, in my Bible, there's a little English title before this section which says, Establishment of the Church. And this... I'm just kidding. That's the tithe.
Well, in my Bible, what it says... No, for me, what it says, establishment of me getting my 10%. Why Keith is supposed to get 10%? So listen, I mean, which one's it going to be here?
Come on, Keith, what does it mean? What do you think that means there?
Well, I think it's pretty clear here. He says, you know, these are the things that I'm looking for. You know, I've had this experience. I've had my dream. I've seen and heard the voice. And now I'm about to go on a journey that says that if you're going to go with me, here's what I will do. You will be my God. And by the way, I'm going to give you a tenth. Like, I guess the way it says it here is, thou shalt give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee. The question that I have is, how does he give it to him?
Well, that's right. And of what does he give? I mean, everything that is his increase, and how does he pass that on? Nehemiah, how do we understand that?
We don't know the answer to that. It's a really good question. How does he dedicate that 10% to Yehovah? If he, he's not giving it to the church or the synagogue or the temple, so what is he doing with it? Mm-hmm. And presumably he's offering it as some kind of a sacrifice that he then consumes. Mm. I would imagine that's what happened. Or maybe he gives it to the poor, you know, because when we get to the Torah commandments, you have this 10% that you have three different options and three different ways of using. You use it on your pilgrimage when you go up to the chosen place, at one time Bethel, at one time Jerusalem. The other option is you give it to the poor, and the third option is you give it to the Levites, who are essentially they're poor by design because they're serving and doing God's work. So you know, he had Levites because he had a son named Levi, but
not at this stage.
So I don't know. I don't think he gave it to his son. I think he probably offered it as a sacrifice or gave it to the poor. I would imagine, but we don't
know
for sure.
Interesting.
Good question.
So this is now.
I'm going to build a.
You need a new denomination.
No, I'm going to build an entire. An entire teaching on this verse. I'm just letting you guys know now.
Hey, I'm looking forward to this.
I'll bet that's going to be a very lucrative teaching.
Yes, it will be. Go ahead.
So Jacob went on his journey and came to the land where of the people of the east. And it goes on to say that there were sheep, there were shepherds. He was talking to them there. There was a well. And he says, look, do you guys know Laban, the son of Nahor? He said, well, they said, we know him. He said, well, is he well? And they said, he is well. And look, his daughter Rachel is coming with the sheep. Enter Rachel. Here she is. And he said, look, it is still high day. It is not time for the... It goes on that she comes along with the sheep. He rolls the stone off the well and allows them for the sheep to be watered. And this is beautiful. It says that they get talking. Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. I just think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
There she is.
Yeah, and I think it's cyclical as we talk about what happened with Abraham's servant in 24. And he goes there and he's looking for the wife. And then now here comes the son of Isaac who comes and he's looking for the wife. And here she is, and it's cyclical. And the one person that's consistent in both stories is Laban in my Bible. And I think as soon as she comes to him and says, hey, there's a guy who's connected to the guy, he's like, oh, I remember the last time.
Ah, yeah.
they came. He's got a very good memory. There's this wonderful thing that happens in this that just catches my attention, and it's that, you know, Jacob is going, he's looking for, you know, his family and his connection to his family, but he falls for Rachel. And it says in verse 16, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And then verse 17 is this thing I can never get it out of my mind. It says, and Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face.
Now, that's a bit rough, isn't it?
I have this thing, Jonah.
Now, I've got to say, hang on, Keith. My New King James is a little bit kinder than that. It says, Leia's eyes were delicate. Now, that's a much nicer way of
saying it. But it says weak.
It says weak? Oh,
yeah.
I feel sorry for her already.
Torah fortune.
Yeah. What it probably meant is, in the context, I know Keith has his explanation, but what I suspect it meant is that she was like a squinter, you know, one of those people who probably, you know, she didn't have glasses and she probably didn't see well, and you could probably see her squinting all the time, and you know, they said that, okay, she has weak eyes. Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe, Keith.
Impossible. Mm-hmm. Keith's got his take on it.
So what's the parallel here in verse 17? Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. But it says in verse 18 that he loved Rachel.
Mm.
So he said, look, I'll do whatever I can to get her. I want the one with the strong eyes.
Yeah, yeah. He said, I will serve you.
And what does Laban say?
Well, he said, I'll serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. I mean, that is really romantic, isn't it?
Am I the only one who thinks it's weird that he's exchanging his daughter for 7 years of labor?
Well,
that's what I was going to say.
I don't know.
What's that about?
The
negotiating. It's Middle Eastern negotiations. Jacob comes and he says, look, I would serve for 7 years. He says, hey, it's better for me to give her to you. It's like Abraham when he's talking to the folks about the Machpelah, the cave and the ground. He's like, look, you know, what's 400 between us? And like, there's negotiation here. He's like, okay, yeah, I'll take your 7 years.
Yeah,
what's interesting is later on they make the same comment in chapter 31, verse 15.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jacob is trying to convince Rachel and Leah to go with him back to the land of Canaan and leave their father, and they say, we were considered like foreigners to him. He sold us. You know, meaning exactly. we have no loyalty to him. He sold us like we were slaves. Like, you know, so they also perceive this as kind of like a cold thing for a father to do, rather than bless his daughters and send them away with some kind of, you know, I don't know,
well,
with
some
kind of a dowry. They sell them into slavery.
And we see later on as well that Laban says, look, in verse 43 of 31, Laban answered and said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters and these children are my children and this flock is my flock and all that you see is mine. And he kind of seems to me to possibly be someone with what Proverbs refers to as an evil eye. Is that possibly a fair speculation?
I think there's definitely here a spirit of Laban, and the spirit of Laban is unjust wages, changing the wage, withholding the wage,
mm-hmm.
requiring unreasonable things from workers. I think in modern terms, maybe we could call this, I might get in trouble for saying this, the spirit of Walmart. Okay, let's move on.
But in any case, children, after Jacob had worked for Laban 7 years, do you know what happened? Laban fooled him and gave him his ugly daughter Leah. So, to marry Rachel, Jacob was forced to work another 7 years. So you see, children, the Bible clearly teaches us that you can never trust an employer.
Jono.
Well, not if he has the spirit of Laban, you can't.
Now, Nehemiah, wait a minute. You know where that's from, right?
You can never trust an employer? What's that from?
My friend. It's one of your favorite movies.
Oh, from Office Space?
Okay.
No, I have no idea. What movie?
Fiddler on the Roof. This is Perchik.
Oh, he says he can never trust an employee. Okay.
Talking to the kids down on the river, and they ask him, is that what the Bible teaches us? And he says, well, that is the lesson of the story of Jacob, if you interpret it correctly. Keith.
I see.
She wasn't an ugly daughter.
I feel sorry for her, poor girl. Mm-hmm.
I don't feel sorry for her, because you know what's amazing about this story?
What's this?
Is that we see this issue of Laban, and we see this issue of Rachel, and we see this issue of Leah, and yet there's this powerful section that gets in where God steps in. And this is what I love about the Bible and the Torah portion. I love the Torah portion because it's very human in its approach to these people's interactions,
mm-hmm.
and then there's this intervention. So there's the interaction with the people, then there's the intervention, then there's the interaction with the people and the intervention, and we see this in this story. So let us continue.
So can I bring something from I want to bring something from Deuteronomy 24,
sure.
verses 14 to 15, because I think these are commandments. You know, we're reading these stories, but I think they're more than just stories. I think they're lessons for mm-hmm. us to learn. And then later those, I think, are translated into various commandments. And so, for example, Deuteronomy 24:14-15, it says, "You shall not oppress a hired worker, a poor person or a pauper, from your brother or for the sojourner in your land and your gates." And what does that mean? The word "oppress" there is a word in Hebrew that implies to take advantage of, treat unfairly, to swindle. Any of those things is called to oppress somebody. And then it says in verse 15, "In his day you will give his wage. Mm-hmm. The sun shall not set upon him, for he is poor," and he basically he needs it, is a rough translation. Mm-hmm. "That he not call against you to Yehovah, and there be a sin upon you." So what it's saying here is, on the day that you're, you know, and they used to have day laborers, they still do in some parts of the world. So what it's saying here, if you have a day laborer, somebody who is, you know, most people in this ancient society, they worked for themselves. It was only somebody like Jacob, who was a foreigner, who didn't have any property, who was, you know, essentially landless and homeless, that came to Laban and said, "Okay, give me a job." So it was only these poor people who needed to work for someone else. And so it's saying somebody who's in that sort of a situation that's working for you, you have to treat him fairly, you have to treat him justly, and you've got to give him his wage in a timely manner. Mm. And if you withhold that wage, he'll call against Yehovah, and there will be a sin upon you. So that's actually a very serious commandment here, I think. One that we don't, you know, I think in our Western society, we don't take very seriously. And I don't know that it has to be literally interpreted that you have to pay your workers every single day. If the agreement is to pay them, I don't know, at the end of every week, the point is you better pay them in the time that you're supposed to pay them. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, that's actually a very serious sin.
Mm-hmm. I want to say something, Jono, and I'm leaving the farm here. I want to say it in advance. But there, you know, there's a book in the New Testament that Luther didn't like, and some of the other people didn't like, and it's actually the Book of James. And there's a section in the Book of James, Nehemiah, that says this. It says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted." And it says, "Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which had been withheld by your cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord Shavuot, the Yehovah Shavuot," mm-hmm. "and you have lived luxury." And it tells this story. What's funny, when I read that, if I read that, and like I say, I'm leaving the farm a little bit, if I read that, I'm like, wow, James is really coming strong here. But if I don't read Deuteronomy and understand that that's where this actually was brought forth, and James is simply pulling from Deuteronomy to remind the people that this is one of the teachings in the Torah and the Tanakh. And I'm only bringing this example because I think one of the things that happens is that things get read in a vacuum sometimes. In my tradition, in the Methodist tradition, you know, we'll go to the New Testament and it'll be completely read in a vacuum, not understanding where it comes from. And what you just did, Nehemiah, is you brought to my mind something I knew in James, but I didn't know in Deuteronomy as well. Now it makes complete sense. Thank you for that. We can get back to this.
All right.
No, appreciate that. So yeah, that's right. He did want to put it at the back of the Bible, didn't he? In fact, he wanted to leave it out. Altogether, he called it
an epistle. Didn't want it in there at all.
An epistle of straw, he called it, because it didn't suit his theology. Anyhow, yeah. Moving right along. Jacob said, now, of course, Laban did that. He didn't pay the wages that he said that he would pay, and he gave him Leah instead of Rachel. He works another 7 years. In the meantime, he works another 7 years, and he gets Rachel as his wife, finally.
He gets her after 7 days, but he has to work 7 years for her. So I want to look at verse 25. It says, "And it came to pass in the morning, and behold, she was Leah. And he said to Laban, to Laban, what is this that you have done? Did I not work with you for Rachel? Why have you deceived me?"
Mm.
So my question is, how did he deceive him?
Well, I'm guessing because it says that there
was children listening, so I'm not going to draw a picture. But they consummated the marriage. How did he not know who he was consummating the marriage with?
Well, it says in 22.
Tell you exactly why.
Go on.
Well, they did it through a sheet.
Back in the... No, listen. Nehemiah. So listen. So first of all, they're not in a hotel room where there's lights. It's dark. Here comes this woman. He's obviously filled with wine from the celebration.
Yeah.
This woman comes in. He thinks it's his wife. He hasn't been with her before this. They get together. He wakes up in the morning. He's like, what happened here? I mean, it seems perfectly clear to me what he did.
Pretty shifty.
Well, I mean, I guess that's what happened, but it definitely raises the question, you know, what was wrong with him that he didn't notice who he was having sex with? I mean, how do you not notice that? I'm sorry, you know.
Well, I'm guessing, you know, it's the, again, as...
You know, he wasn't talking to her. He wasn't, you know, I mean, come on. What is this?
No, it was in the nighttime. It was after they were
celebrating. Did her mother dress her with the skins of... of sheep to when he fell to her and she was hairy. I don't understand how he fell for this.
The bottom line,
I do understand, but I'm saying this is shocking that he fell for something like this.
Yeah, I mean, imagine waking up in the morning and my goodness. And there's no going back from that, right? There's no going back. This is it now. So he ends up with two wives.
I guess you can't undo that, huh?
I guess you can't undo it. Now, just quickly.
He gets two for one.
He gets two for the – well, no, because he's got to work for another 7 years. But now he has – now everybody asks this question. Now he has sisters for wives, and we know there's a law against that as well. Nehemiah, how do you reconcile that?
That's a really interesting question. So if you look in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 18 – the specific commandment is a woman to her sister you shall not take, to trouble, to uncover her nakedness in addition to her in her lifetime. So this is understood in two different ways. The more common interpretation is to say, well, it's two literal sisters, and you can't marry two sisters that are both living. You know, what would happen is if you were married to a woman and you had children with her and then she died, what would very often happen is they would go and marry her sister to take care of, you know, so the new wife would take care of her nieces and nephews. So that's when the woman isn't living. Here it's saying while she's alive, you can't marry two sisters because that troubles her. The other understanding of this, which I tend towards, even though it's probably less common, is that, you know, you have this phrase in various places in the Bible, a woman to her sister, which really means one and then another one. Mm-hmm. And according to that understanding, this is simply saying you can't marry two women while the first woman is alive, because that's troubling to the first woman. If that interpretation is true, of course, it raises questions like, why did Hannah, you know, why was she married to a second, you know, as a second wife?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, David had lots of wives.
There aren't actually that many
examples from the period of Moses on. Actually, we have Hannah and we have the various kings. And then I think we'd be hard pressed to find many more examples. There may be a few. Hannah specifically refers to the other wife as her troubler, using the exact same word that appears in Leviticus 18:18, which may indicate that Hannah's husband was in violation of this commandment. In any event, either way, I would tend to think that just as we have Laban as a picture of what we're not supposed to do, and then a commandment that then goes along with that, that this is a commandment that then goes along with Jacob's dysfunctional family. And that rather than being something we're supposed to emulate, that Jacob is actually something we're supposed to learn from is what not to do. Mm-hmm. That you end up having, I mean, look, that he had four wives, and they all, certainly the two main wives, were at each other's throat constantly to the point where they're, you know, she's pimping out her husband in exchange for some mandrakes. I mean, that's horrendous. Mm. And I think that's there as an example of what we're not supposed to do, and that this is a commandment that then formulates that, meaning what's the word I'm looking for? I mean, this essentially formulates what it is we're not supposed to do, whereas the actual, like, vibrant example is the example of Jacob. Mm. That's my take. The more traditional explanation, by the way, is to say, well, that was before the Torah was given, so he was allowed to do that. Which, okay, that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Keith?
I like my explanation better.
Well, the thing that hits me when I'm reading this story is I can't read this story without thinking about Jacob's life, and I can't read this story without thinking of Isaac. I can't read it without thinking of what happened before and how this sort of smells like some of the same things. And specifically, I just want us to do one little Torah pearl here, if we can, if we have time.
Torah pearl.
I want you to open up to 30 verse 25. Mm-hmm. And when I read this verse, I think about what happened with Jacob and his brother and what his brother said. And it almost sounds exactly the same, but there's a difference that you don't find in English, only in Hebrew. Verse 25, it says, and so it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah, and he said to Laban, why is it that you have done this to me? Now, immediately I think about older brother, younger brother, older sister, younger sister. Was it not for Rachel did I serve you? Why then have you deceived me? Now, in English, when we see deceive me, what do you think I think, Jono? When I hear him say, why have you deceived me?
Well, the first thing that entered my mind was the situation where Jacob deceived his father.
Exactly. And what did his brother say about him? Is that not why you called him? But what's interesting in Hebrew, Nehemiah, can you just tell us, why is it a different word at the end of 25? Why doesn't Jacob use his name? In other words, why does he use this word?
Because that is a very unusual word for deceive, the word, you know, the word akev. And so this is probably, I think this is a more common word. But there's definitely a connection there that you reap what you sow, and how
that's
how,
what I was trying
how,
to get to.
You know, how appropriate that the one who you know acted with deception then ended up getting deceived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would say in modern Hebrew, magialo, he had it coming. But we see this throughout the Bible that we saw before that Lot tried to offer up his daughters for rape and he ended up getting raped by them. You know, you have this true poetic justice.
Mm-hmm.
In Hebrew, it's called midah keneged midah, or reciprocal justice, they call
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what hit me, guys, was this: is that here he takes the blessing from his older brother. In other words, he sets his older brother aside. He gets the blessing, and now the older sister gets married to him. It's like you say, it's cyclical. It's like I'm watching this happen, and I'm like, man, does this not sound familiar? You know, he tries to get the younger to give her the blessing, and he gets the older.
anyway,
that was the verse I wanted to bring.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant, actually. That's a really, really interesting connection. Verse 30, then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban still another 7 years. When Yehovah saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb. And that's great. I mean, Yehovah seems to look
there's
down,
that intervention.
There it is. There's that intervention that you're talking about, and because you kind of do feel sorry for her, you know. And at least I do, and I think that's beautiful. He opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, mm-hmm. and she called his name Reuben. So what does Reuben mean, Nehemiah?
Well, okay, but let's go through all these names.
Mm.
So we have Reuven, and it says, for she said, Yehovah has seen my affliction, for now my husband will love me. And Reuven is two words, Reu, see, and Ben, son. So literally, see a son. And that's connected to her saying that Yehovah has seen. And then we have the next one is Shimon, or Simeon.
Mm-hmm.
That says, for Yehovah heard that I was hated. And Shimon is from the word Shama, to hear. Yehovah heard. And then we have verse 34. This time my husband will join me, for I gave birth, I birthed to him three sons. And a child was called Levi, or Levi.
Mm-hmm.
And Levi is from the word Yilaveh, he will join. And let's bring the one more name, and we'll talk about that. And then in verse 35, she says, Odet Yehovah, I will thank Yehovah, and the child's called Yehudah, which is a combination of the words Odet and Yehovah. And so, you know, it's actually both words. Yeho-Odet, I will thank Yehovah. So each of these names has an explanation and the explanation is connected to what the word means. The word Levi, I guess we got to talk about that. Because Levi, she says, this time my husband will join me, and well, I'll ask Keith to talk about that. Keith, where else do we have a play on words related to the name Levi and joining?
Well, I think if you go to the verse, for those of us that are Methodists that are trying to find our way to connect with the God of Israel, short of having to put on a kippah in the traditional Orthodox movement, are going to become converted in some other way. If I want to join myself, it says in Isaiah, that 56, I believe it is,
mm-hmm.
that those who join themselves, the very word join is this very word that's used for Levi. So
mm-hmm.
when we join ourselves, when we Levite ourselves to him, then we become a part of his covenant, a part of his time, his Torah, his name. And that's been my money ball verse. That's what I connect to all the time, is that I'm joining myself to him, and therefore I'm connected to the God of Israel.
And what Keith is talking about is Isaiah 56, verse 3, and then again in verse 6, it has this word nilva or nilvim, which is those who join. And it says, nilvim al Yehovah, who join themselves to Yehovah, to serve him, and love the name of Yehovah, to be his servants, all those who keep the Shabbat from desecrating it and grab hold of my covenant. And then he says in verse 7, I will bring them to my holy mountain and make them rejoice in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices shall be accepted upon my altar. Now, a lot of people read this and they say, well, where did the burnt offerings and peace offerings come from? What's that about?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a play on words with the word Levite, because normally a Levite brings, the Kohanim, the priests who are with it, or a subcategory within Levi,
mm-hmm.
they're the ones who bring the sacrifices. And what the Israelites thought is, well, a Gentile can't bring a sacrifice. And there's a verse in Leviticus that was probably misunderstood why they thought that, and which is a whole separate discussion. We get to that verse, we'll talk about it. But anyway, here he's saying, not only will they Levite themselves to me, to Yehovah, but their sacrifices will be accepted. They're going to present sacrifices like the Levites present sacrifices.
Mm.
And not to say that they're going to, you know, be priests in the temple, literally, but that you think that they can't join themselves to Yehovah, that they're separated, and you think they can't bring sacrifices. Not only will they be joined, but their sacrifices will be accepted upon my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Yeah. And
yes,
and Jono, And guess what else, Jono?
Yes, Keith.
Now that I'm a Levite and I've connected myself,
oh,
I want
here it
the
comes.
10%.
Here it comes. Show me the money. Show me the money.
Please go to hishollywoodname.com to the donate section and bring me my 10%. I'm just kidding. No, what's powerful about this, Nehemiah? No, what's powerful about this, and I think we see it in English, but it's so powerful in Hebrew because these words that are these word connections, these word puns that are they're so powerful, they just jump off the page. You know what I mean? And in English, we can see obviously that there's something connected to becoming attached and Levi, and you know it says what it says. But boy, I tell you what, it's such a blessing to have the ability to look right at the Hebrew language and to see these words jump off. It's like watching 3D HD is the way I like to say it.
So here we are in chapter 30. That was a Torah bill. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I'll die." I mean, what's with that? I mean, that's anyway. And so Jacob's anger was aroused, fair enough, against Rachel. And he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld you from the fruit of the womb?" So she said, "Look, here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, and she will bear she will bear children on my knees, that I may have children by her." So she gave him Bilhah. So I mean, this is not unusual. I guess we already see this with Sarah and Hagar. Sarah gives
Abram.
Certainly
unusual to us, but apparently that was the custom in ancient times that if you had a maidservant and you didn't have children, she could have children for you that were then kind of like an ancient version of a surrogate pregnancy, except that, it's actually her child, like genealogically, physically.
And so, but this effectively makes Bilhah his wife, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Yeah, it says that.
Okay, so here's wife number three. Bilhah conceived and bore a son, and Rachel said, "God has judged my case, and he has also heard my voice and given me a son." Therefore, she called his name. She gets to call his name. She called his name Dan.
And so here we have another series of names.
Mm-hmm.
We have Dan, or Dan in English. Dan, which means he judged. And she says, "God judged me and also heard my voice." And the judged me is Danani. So that's related, where you get the name Dan. And then you have in verse 8, I'll just go quickly through these names. We have Naphtali, or Naphtali, Naphtali in Hebrew. And Naphtali, as she says, "Naphtule Elohim Niftalti." I've literally translated, "The wrestlings of God I've wrestled with my sister and also prevailed." And that's interesting, the phrase "wrestlings of God." How does your English translation have it, out of curiosity?
I've got, Rachel said, "With great wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and indeed I have prevailed."
So they interpreted the word God in this context as great, meaning, and that's not wrong, I mean, that's correct. Sometimes in Hebrew, when it adds the word God to a phrase, it means like really, really, really great, because God is, you know, the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
So immense wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, but literally divine or wrestlings of God is a literal translation. Mm-hmm. I have wrestled with my sister and also prevailed. And then he was called Naphtali, which from the word wrestlings. And then verse 11, the child is called God, because she says, "Ba God, fortune has come." Which is very interesting, because what does that mean, fortune? And, you know, our culture is so pagan that for us, fortune is like this, you know, mystical concept, you know, the god of fortune. And that's actually mentioned in the book of Isaiah, how they worshipped a god, a deity, named God, named Fortune. So God is the god of fortune.
Mm.
And or later it's taken to mean the god of fortune, I should say. Here I think it has the literal sense of fortune. And what happens is that pagans, what they do is that they personify everything. Meaning they turn it into like a living, thinking thing, you know, so they'll take rain and they'll have the god of rain.
Mm.
And in some cultures, it'll just be called rain. You know, and so here we have God, which means fortune, like we would say in English, good luck, but they turn luck into a god. I don't think that's what she meant when she said God. Now then you have, of course, the sacred namers who will come along. I call those people the word police. And they'll say, "Well, we can't say the English word G-O-D, God, because there was a pagan deity called God, Gimel Dalad, or in English, G-A-D. And I'm like, "Well, wait a minute. In English, the word God has nothing to do with fortune. It's completely unrelated."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, I don't know, ridiculous. But anyway, that's the word police. Okay, verse 13, we have Asher. She says in that women, or the daughters, will in my joy, because the daughters will make me rejoice. And the word asher comes from the word rejoice. And then we have the story of the mandrakes. I'll stop there.
All right. Because, yeah, the mandrake. Does anybody know what a mandrake is? I've got no idea.
So actually, there is an opinion about what the mandrake is. It's widely accepted by botanists. It's some plant that has all kinds of medical properties that grows here in Israel. And it was believed, I guess, at some point that it functioned as an aphrodisiac, or possibly to even cause a fertility aid.
Sure.
I don't know that we really know what it is. I know there's definitely strong opinions about what it is, but it really leaves a question: why were these mandrakes so important? It was obviously something rare that they couldn't grow domestically, and so he had to like find it. Mm.
It's obvious what they were.
What is
I have
it?
The answer.
What is it?
No. I'm telling you, the mandrakes are the basis for why they have these present products right now for men. Jacob was getting tired. He needed the stamina. And so the mandrakes helped him in his stamina so that he could be with his two wives to raise these children. This is exactly what happened.
Well, it seems that way, because okay. It's like, look, I've got mandrakes, so come on, tonight's the night, because I've got mandrakes. Here they are.
Obviously, that's what her point was. Like, Ursa, coming and saying, look, yeah. here's what you need. I mean, obviously that's what it was.
Wait, but the one who ended up sleeping with him wasn't the one who had the mandrakes. She's the one who gave up the mandrakes.
I know she gave up the mandrakes, but that was what she used. My point is that you need these mandrakes. I need those mandrakes from you. Okay.
There's a market for that somewhere. There's also a market for various rods for animals. We're going to get to that in a minute, in a similar sort of thing. But God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Here we go. There's a few more names. This is Issachar.
Okay, so Yisachar in Hebrew, which comes from the word sachar, reward, and here is actually two names. She says, God has given me my reward because I gave my maidservant to my husband. Reward is schari, so therefore he was called Yisachar. But then also she rented or hired her husband, which is sachor sachar ticha. I have surely rented you or hired you. So it's a double meaning there. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about the name Yisachar is its pronunciation. This was actually a debate between two families of scribes a little over, like around 1,200 years ago. And one of the families of Jewish scribes wrote the name as Yisachar, and that's actually what we have in our Bibles. And the other family, that was called Ben Asher, by the way, and the other family, which was called Ben Naphtali, their rivals, they wrote the name as Yisachar. And that was a difference that was preserved in these lists they had of the differences of the different scribal families. Mm-hmm. Yisachar and Yisachar. Mm-hmm. But we say Yisachar in Hebrew, according to Ben Asher. But it's possible that it was Yisachar. And according to the Ben Asher version, there's a silent shin, which is the only time in the Hebrew language you have that in this particular word. Yeah.
Interesting.
A silent Zebulun. Shin in the middle of the word.
Mm-hmm. Zebulun, verse 20.
Zvulun. So Zvulun is Yizbeleni Ishi. She says, my husband will live with me, is a proper translation of that, or will dwell with me.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore he is called Zvulun, dwelling. And then we have the girl Dina, mm-hmm. and it doesn't say why she's called Dina. So why is she called Dina? I mean, it's kind of obvious in Hebrew. It comes from the word judgment. It's actually the feminine of Dan, of Dan.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So then,
it gave that explanation. Didn't need to repeat it. For Dan, it gave the explanation. So
there it is. Verse 22. Then God remembered
it's
Rachel.
It's obvious.
Yeah, it's obvious. Obviously, God remembered Rachel. What, he had forgotten her? She'd been forgotten.
Whenever it says God remembers someone, it means that he's, as Keith would say, he's interacting with them.
Uh-huh.
Whereas so now, before, yes, he's interacting with them.
Yeah, before he wasn't, I guess.
So he's acting on her behalf. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son.
So
Joseph.
Again, that's a double meaning. Asaf, it means he has gathered, God has gathered my reproach. Asaf, gathered. And then also she says, Yosef, Yehovah li ben achel, Yehovah will add for me another son. So the name Yosef is Yehovah adds and also gathers. And what's interesting is the two names, Judah and Joseph, if I'm not mistaken, are the first two names in history. Somebody correct me here if I'm wrong. The first two names in history that have Yehovah, Yud-Heh-Vav, incorporated into them. And with Joseph, Yosef, it's really the full form of his name appears elsewhere in the Bible as Yehosef, with the Yeho. Mm-hmm. And then Yehuda has Yehu. And why is it Yehu and Yehuda? That's because you have really Yeho-Odeh, and the Hebrew doesn't like two O's in a row, and that becomes an U. which is kind of like a technical thing in Hebrew. But those are the first two names already in the children of Jacob who have Yehovah's name incorporated into them.
That is interesting.
And what's interesting about that, Nehemiah, is that when you brought that up, is that the obvious first reading of that, you don't see that. We can't smell that anywhere, not until we get into Yehoshua. Mm-hmm. Do we see that? But here,
I see it. I don't,
that
maybe you don't see it, but I see it. I mean, I don't know.
It's obvious, right?
I'm helping the people that are listening.
Oh, okay. No, it actually is
eventually
obvious.
You're going to realize I'm trying to help the people that are listening.
Uh-huh.
So, how would a person have normally? In other words, if you're reading, you just got through saying that there were changes in the letters for Judah. And can you just say that one more time regarding
it wasn't that there was changes. It's that, you know, there are certain things in language that languages don't like. And when a language doesn't like something, it makes a change within the language and within a spoken language. Like cannot becomes can't. It's like a contraction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes it easier to pronounce when you say can't. So there, both forms exist: cannot and can't. So in ancient Hebrew, you have Yehoodeh, which is I will thank Yehovah, and then she calls his name Yehuda. And why does she call his name Yehuda or Yehuda actually? Why does she call him that? Because you have these two O's in a row, and in Hebrew that causes something called dissimilation, which then creates an ooh. You have that in other, other words like, there's a guy named Jehu, or in Hebrew Yehu, which is really Yehohu. And so it doesn't become Yohu because that just doesn't work in Hebrew. So through dissimilation, it becomes Yehu. It's the same sort of thing as Yehuda. Mm-hmm. You have an ooh here, which displaces the O in certain contexts.
So it came to pass when Rachel had...
This was a Torah pearl.
That was a Torah pearl.
That's a Torah pearl.
Had borne
Joseph. That Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place, to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go. For you know that I have served my service which I have done for you." Laban said, "Please stay. If I found favor in your eyes, I have learned by experience that Yehovah has blessed me for your sake." He said, "Name your wages."
What do you mean by experience?
Well, obviously, things were going good.
No, but not by experience. It was but through divination that he learned these things.
What he says. He says that.
You're kidding. What does it say?
He says, "Nichashti, I have divined, that and Yehovah has blessed me because of you." And what that means, divined, is he dripped oil into a cup, or he did something like that. And based on that, he got the message that, Yehovah has blessed you because of me.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
He was a pagan.
He was
Pagan's
a pagan.
Divine.
So it's not.
No, you got to catch the pearls here. This is a pearl. It's obvious to me.
It's obvious in the text.
I didn't even know that was a question in English. I mean,
you heard Jonah say that I've learned through experience. No, not through experience.
Mm-hmm. By divination.
Go ahead, Jonah.
And so it goes on, and he says, "Look, stick around because it's all good." He says, "Well, I'll tell you what. Give me all the." Jacob says, "Give me the speckled sheep, the spotted sheep, the goats that are brown, and you can have all the white ones, and it's all good." And here we go with a little bit of experimentation with some rods. Now Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar, and of the almond and the chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters. In the water troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. And so here's another aphrodisiac, if you like.
Well, this I got to say is one of the most bizarre passages in the Bible. And the reason it's bizarre is it really sounds like he's performing some kind of magic. And it leaves me wondering, what on earth, why is he doing this? What is the function of these sticks? Did he believe? And it sounds like it. It sounds like he believed that putting these sticks next to the sheep while they're copulating is going to, produce certain results in how their offspring come out. And that's not true. So the question is, why was he doing it? Although, to be honest,
and there's an answer.
What's the answer?
We have the answer.
What's the
answer? Answer is in what this lovely little thing I love to say, which is keep reading. The answer is in chapter 31, verse 11.
Mm-hmm. That the angel spoke to him. Is that what you're talking about?
He says now,
right.
And he tells him, this is what you're going to do, and he doesn't explain why. And it's what I think is amazing about it is that, again, reading it the first time, and I remember Nehemiah and I doing a study on this too, and trying to figure out, was it the speckled and the spotted, and you try to figure out, why did this happen and why did that happen, and then when you get to verse 11, and it says he had a dream, and it says, and he said, listen, and he said, lift up now your eyes and see that the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled, or whatever, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing with you. I'm the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, blah, 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 blah. And you know, it's like saying, I'm going to enter into this situation. I'm going to let you see what's going on, and then I'm going to give you an opportunity to understand.
Well,
it,
I mean, look, so that
it, without explaining.
So the dream he has with the angel is actually when he, you know, at the end of the 20 years when he's about to leave, because the continuation of that dream is, okay, now go back to land Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe an angel spoke to him before and interacted with him on these different types of sheep and spotted and speckled. And okay, but that's a guess, and it could be a correct guess, but it's not explicit in the text. And it's definitely a valid question. What on earth is he doing with these sticks? And why is he peeling little strips in them and stripes in them? And I don't have an answer.
I always thought that perhaps he was putting it in the water, and there was some properties about these sticks that enhanced the fertility of the sheep and the goats. I don't know. That's how I read it.
What's the significance of cutting the stripes in them?
Cutting it open so that they would weep into the water.
Oh, could be. All right. Could be.
Maybe.
It definitely is a question.
It's bizarre. Now, Jacob heard the words of Laban's son saying...
Wait, Jonah, why are you moving so quickly here? This is a chance for you to increase your goat flocks now. Don't you understand?
Well, I'll do. You know what? I do have
Aren't
an.
Are you going to go do this? Or
you
not?
Know, I have to admit, I
think
do
you
have
need
a,
to do an experiment.
All right, I'll tell you what. I do have an almond tree outside, and I might do some experiments. I'll get back to you in a few months on that one. Okay.
Okay.
Now,
okay, excellent.
Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, "Jacob has taken away all that our father that was his, and from what was ours, and he's acquired it for himself." And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed, it was not favorable towards him. And this begins the great escape, isn't it?
Yes.
Got to get away. Laban, and which was, of course, followed by the pursuit. And
can I point out one thing in verse 3?
Go on.
We have here Yehovah speaking to Jacob. He says, "Return to the land of your father, to your birthplace." And he says, "Ve'heyeh imach," and I will be with you. And that phrase, "and I will be with you," "ehyeh," is a play on words with the name Yehovah, he that is, he that was, he that is, and he that will be. And we see that later in the story of Moses, that he keeps saying, "Ehyeh imach, ehyeh imcha," I will be with you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something, you know, that's like something you could, you know, blur by really quickly, but in Hebrew it jumps out that "ehyeh," I will be, is connected to the father's name.
And it refers back to what did Jacob say? He said, "Listen, we're going to do this deal. I'm going to give you the 10% if you'll be with me." And it's like, you know, it's like him being reminded again, "Yes, ehyeh, I will be with you." And it's like, okay, you know, and of course, where was he going to be with him? He told him where he was going to be with him, and he was going to bring him back to that land. So, I mean, it's the circumstances, again, of humankind, what's going on. But do we not think orchestrator, maestro's not behind it, saying, "I'm going to trouble your, I'm going to get you to a place where you don't settle in and say, I'm going to stay here with Laban. I'm going to give you the motivation and the desire to leave." And, of course, this is according to his promise anyway.
And so, as you pointed out, Nehemiah and Keith, in verse 27, Laban learned by divination, not experience, but by divination. And we find out in his pursuit, when he finally catches up with Jacob, who had escaped with his wives, his children, and all of his herd and flock, he catches up and he says, "Now you've disappeared on me, but not only that, you also, in verse 30, you've also taken my household gods. You stole my gods," my teraphim, I think is the word. Is that correct,
right?
Nehemiah?
Teraphim, or actually teraphim.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the question is, why did Rachel steal these teraphim? What was she going to do with them? And I guess she was going to worship them.
What else?
You know, some historians who have struggled with this question have suggested that, well, the belief in the ancient world was that if you possess the teraphim, these teraphim, that these household idols, that it entitled you to the birthright of inheritance from your father. But there's really not a lot of evidence for that in any of the ancient sources. And I think that's kind of like whitewashing why she did it. I think the reason she did it is she, you know, was used to praying to them, used to offering things to them, you know, sacrifices to them, and didn't want to go, you know, didn't want to be away from their protection.
Mm-hmm.
I guess old habits die hard is the lesson here. You know, and later on, there's a scene in you know, a future section where Jacob takes all the idols that are in his household and he buries them under a tree.
Under a tree,
because,
yeah.
You know, they left the land of Padan Aram, the city of Haran, and they were influenced there by this paganism. And when they came back to the land of Canaan, they had to shed that off of themselves. You know, first they returned to the land, and it was only after they returned that they had to shed off this layer of idolatry.
And it seems that she was able to hold on to them until that point, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Well, she's sitting on them.
She's sitting on them. You don't want to go
she
there.
She is the oldest excuse in the book.
Yep. It's that time of the month. Leave me alone.
In your presence, because the way of women is to me.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah, you've heard that excuse before.
Yep. Keith.
Continue.
What,
no, I have to continue. Quickly. Quickly, Jono. And do your reading thing.
That's probably what Laban thought, and he was out of there. And anyways, she got to keep them. Laban answered and said to Jacob, this is verse 43, these daughters are my daughters, these are my children, this is my flock, everything you see is mine, but what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have born? Now, therefore, come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So he gets a great stone, he sets it up as a pillar, and then everyone sort of, you know, throws a whole lot of stones around it, makes it into a big heap, and Jacob calls it Galeed.
This is actually one of the most interesting verses in the Torah, verse 47 of Genesis chapter 31, and I'll translate it literally. It says, and Lavan called it Yegar Sahaduta, and Jacob called it Galeed. Now, what's interesting about this is that Yegar Sahaduta and Galeed have the exact same meaning, except Yegar Sahaduta is Aramaic. And Galed is Hebrew.
That is
Galed means pile testimony. Gal is a pile of stones. And Yigal Sahaduta literally means, or pile witness, I should say, is Galed. And Yigal Sahaduta is pile testimony. So they have actually not the exact same meaning, but a very similar meaning. And this is the first time that we're hearing somebody speak a foreign language. And that foreign language here is the Aramaic, which makes sense because Laban lived in the land of he lived in the city of Haran, which today is on the border of Turkey and Syria on the Euphrates River, and the region that Haran was located in was called Padan Aram, and Aram is the word Aramaic, where you get the word Aramaic from, and they had originally come from the city of Ur, which was in the land of Aram Naharaim, Aram between the two rivers, that is what we call today Mesopotamia in Iraq, between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. So they come from Aram Naharaim, Aram between the two rivers, and they go to Padan Aram. And so Laban still speaks that foreign language, the language of Aramea, of the Aramaic language of Aramea, whereas Abraham is now speaking the language of, really, of his ancestors, which is Hebrew, Ivrit, the language of Eber. Eber was the son of Shem, and that was the original language before the flood, before the Tower of Babel, whereas Aramaic is this bastardized form of Hebrew. It's a form of Hebrew that was created at the Tower of Babel. It's kind of like a corrupt Hebrew. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of similarities, but it's different enough where they actually call it by a different name.
And with that, we're going to end our
story. No, not ending it there, Keith. I know you want to add something to that, surely.
No. I'm just... Can people understand why this has been so amazing to me? Mm-hmm. Here I've had 10 years with Nehemiah as a friend and as a study partner. And, you know, I mean, he's like a walking, treasure of pearls in the Torah chest. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just have to tell you, it's been such a blessing.
Well, I think there's also a paradigm here that we see throughout later in Scripture when Jeremiah in chapter 10 has a prophecy for the Gentiles. He all of a sudden switches over to Aramaic, and he actually says that prophecy in Aramaic. And what we see here, the paradigm, is that Jacob and his descendants speak Hebrew. The language of the Gentiles is Aramaic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we see repeatedly. We see that later also in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, that Aramaic becomes the language that they communicate to the Gentiles, and with the Aramaic letter in Ezra 4.
Got to be significant. All right, we are rapidly running out of time, but I'm going to jump ahead to verse 53. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their fathers judge between us, Jacob says to Laban. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. What does that mean? What does it mean to swear by the fear of his father?
Well, fear is another word saying worship. So Isaac's worship of the God, of his God, of the God of Abraham.
Okay, good enough. Mm. And so he makes a covenant with Laban, and finally Laban departs and returns to his place. That's all over. We can move on. And here we are in a couple of verses by which the Torah portion ends, and it's kind of odd. And I want you guys to kind of explain this to me. It says, so Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. G'day, Jacob. When Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. I mean, it sounds like a camp of angels. Sounds like a whole bunch of them. And he called the place, the name of that place, what do we call that?
Machanaim, which is very interesting because Machanaim means the two camps. So what were the two camps? Mm-hmm. And I guess the one camp was the camp of angels and the other was Jacob's camp. presumably. Or maybe there were two camps of God's angels. I don't know.
Perhaps. Okay. All right. That's all we have to say on that one? We're not going to elaborate there?
That's all I got for now.
Okay. That's all we got for right now. It's the end of the portion.
It's the end of the portion.
Well, I mean, there's stuff to talk about in the next verse, but then we'll get to that next week.
We'll get to that next week. And right before we go, Keith, did you want to add anything, or are we going to close this up?
Well, all I got to say is we got three camps. We have an international collaboration of looking at Torah portions, and why I get so motivated every single week to do this is the different perspectives that we have, but the finding the common ground in the Word of God. And so it's just been a honor to be with you guys, and I hope just that people are being blessed by this. It really is fun.
Amen. I love you guys. All right. Thank you, Nehemiah Gordon and Keith Johnson. You're on Truth to You with the Torah Pearls, and next week is Vayishlach. Is it?
Vayishlach.
Thank you, my friend. Bereshit 32:3-36, verse 46. In the meantime, listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.